and Taylor Guitars again.
First note is a clam, so I just start all over.
Good up here.
used to think that if I just admitted that it was time for me to say something and then explained why that was so difficult to say, you know, that it would get me over that hump. But I've done that so many times now that it does no longer get me over the hump. And so I've decided to begin these sets by some other admission of guilt. Nothing leaps to mind. It's just that you have to say something, you know, and it's, I don't want to. That's very few people who can just remain silent. I mean, we have to. Who could do that, I wonder? Marcel Marceau. Sailed a foreign country and walked upon that shore. I guess the guy she married was the best part of my life. She dug in cause he drove a pickup truck. Capacity for metaphor, which would be an exercise in futility. I can't get enough of it. What I don't have is any judgment about metaphor, and I wound up with tunes that I really enjoy playing, but I hate to hear them named. And people will call them out in the audience, and I just want to look to see if they're. Deflect the, what am I trying to say? It's mortifying to me to think that I could have thought that the titles I thunk up were worth hearing once, let alone every time I played it for the rest of my life. And when I did my first record, I was trying to learn how to dive, and I had a friend who dove, but as I learned, once I was certified properly, he was nuts, and he was willing to risk his life for, a bubble. And we went out to this quarry where supposedly I was going to learn to dive, and he put on a wetsuit that was made out of a tablecloth. It was... submerged, and he came back after a while. You know, quarries get really deep, but this guy had no concept of the dens or depth, or, except that he wanted to be down there. He came up and said that he had left because it stunk. These quarries accumulate evidently some kind of chemical, maybe sulfur or sulfuric acid or something of the sort, at depth, and it seeps in through your mask and you can smell it. But he didn't have to tell me that. Because if it's strong enough to seep into your mask, it's strong enough to blanket the saran wrap you're wearing for a wetsuit. And this was out in the woods, but he stunk up the woods and repelled me. And it was on that day that I came up with a title. To mention a bunch of liner notes while he was down there in the stink and nothing else. Liner notes that I wish I could live down. My friend John Fay died in February this year. And I was reminded of his facility with Metaphor. Great guitar player, the guy who gave me my job, taught me all that I know about turtles. Yeah. Just ask me, you know. He has a title, The Portland Cement Factory at Monolith, California. Priced perfect. There isn't room for any interpretation. Nothing to be ashamed of. Nothing you'd particularly want to hear, having heard the title, but it's a perfect title. And it wasn't until I was sitting at his funeral while a Kodo player who had sort of, I don't know what their job is, or whoever that is that plays at the beginning of a funeral. It's not the opening act, I know. But they kind of function in the same capacity. And she was sat there with her Kodo, which, by the way, is a deafeningly loud instrument. I thought they would be at that level you hear them at, you know, and cheap. In that movie with Marlon Brando in it, where he pretends to be something he's not. This happens sometimes when I'm having more fun than the audience is. They get off on this stuff, and nobody else does. Anyhow, she finished playing her stuff and it was good, and she couldn't get her Kodo out of the building. They had to wait for her to, I guess out of, you know, respect for the dead, for the Kodo player to get her axe out of the funeral parlor, but she couldn't get it out. It was bigger and heavier than she was. The door was too small. I had to wonder how she got it in there. Which led me to wondering how they got John in there, since he was bigger than the Kodo, especially in his container. And so this reverie had overwhelmed me, but before long, and I remembered the Portland Cement Factory at Monolith, California, and that's when it struck me that that's a haiku. It's perfectly haikuistic. It's 17 syllables. Just for something else you don't care about, Jack Kerouac left a haiku laying around that we wouldn't know about except for Allen Ginsberg, who gave a class that was so boring and so didactic and the opposite of what you might expect from Allen Ginsberg that one of the students in the class kept a written record of it, day by day, blow by blow. And at one point he mentions the haiku that Jack Kerouac wrote, which was his, The winter fly in my medicine cabinet has died of old age. Makes your heart pound. Does mine. By now I should have thought of something to play. I know what I got into this because I started something and I was out of tune. Now I'm so... Thank you. I've been on the outside, seen from far away. Every day that I live for you, all I do is say. People talk about how they feel, but I never hear. You know they only want to get along. I only want you here. I only want you. Song of the whippoorwill beneath a cloudy sky. Your love stands in front of me while I go floating by. While I go floating by. So standing on the outside can't be so terribly bad. It's all easy to get along with what you never had. With what you never had. With what you never had. Thank you. things. You may turn me back on. Some of us in here sit around. Where is there a disco above us or below us? Downstairs. Shh. I think they heard that. I used to, you know, you get these. I can't think of an example right now, but let's. And you do that for about 10 hours straight, right? Some of you have done this. You know, because you can hear that, but you can't find it here. So you do it at somebody else's house. And I used to go over to my friend, we'll call him Jim. I'd go over to his house. And, and he would and play this stuff, you know, the things that I was working on at the time. Trying to find my, I hadn't yet discovered this deal where you lead with a different finger other than the one that you're expecting to lead with. Whether or not anyone else is expecting to, if you go ahead and lead with a different one than the one you had expected, everything changes. It's why, that's actually, well, I was about to expound further, but I don't think I will. No. I was going to go to West Africa and the history of dry guitar. Because everything is backwards there, and it drives people like me crazy, because I want to be backwards too, and I can't figure out how to do it. Except that it has something to do with where you put the push or the and or the pull. You know who does it really well is Earl Scruggs when he's playing guitar. In the early Flat and Scruggs records, those guitar solos, I am told by people who should know, were taken by Earl, not by Lester Flatt. And Earl was a masterpiece. He's a masterpiece of adding beats and dropping beats, so that you're always missing the step or hitting a step that you didn't know was there, half a step before you took the step, and all of that kind of thing, so that you're never once thinking you know where you are. But on the other hand, in the hands of a musician, you don't care that you don't know where you are. You just feel secure in somebody else's idea of what reality is. It's insane, really, but it's good for you. But I didn't know any of that, and I would sit over at Jim's house, and I'd... And do that for 10 hours a day. Just been he and Mimi had just gotten married. They got divorced a year later. And I've never, never felt responsible for that. But on the other hand, I have to admit, I couldn't have been any help. Oh, Leo's there again. Oh, Leo, can't you get? And I was talking to Jim the other day, I forget why, because we don't talk that often. And he reminded me of what he did after his divorce, when his mind went and he was grief, agony, and all of that. He moved to and we reminisced, because he moved to Colorado and joined a commune. And no one said he probably started the commune. I mean, a commune will begin if somebody says, here's a commune. You know, there's always a handful of other people who are looking for one. It's the only excuse you need. That's why they last about 10 minutes and reform somewhere else. So the Jim and his commune lived up in the sticks somewhere around Colorado. And Jim had one day accomplished something that he'd wanted to accomplish for many years, not just in the course of his divorce, but in the course of deciding what life was about and that to which he might aspire. He took too much acid and went out of his mind. He loved it until things began to, cave in on him. And he seized up, evidently. I mean, he had a seizure, a fit or something. He went out in the middle of some, telling the rest of the commune what the world was really about, now that Jim knew. He'd taken off all his clothes, and he's standing there screaming at these people from the Bronx up in the woods in Colorado about what the world is. Just, who needs you? And out he went. And he doesn't remember this part of it, of course, but we can surmise what happened. The commune, his fellow communards, decided, now that he's out cold and maybe dying, that what he needed to be... Is that mine? Oh, no. Am I going to have to watch this now? I know they're backed up in the kitchen. You know, I was playing once in the... Northampton. I forgot that they served food there, and I looked down, and there was this, and the stage then was incredibly small, and it was about as big as your feet, and right there by my toe was a big sort of white thing, And I said, "What's that?" to the woman closest to it. And she looked at me and didn't say anything. And I was upset. You get arty up here. And I thought I deserved a response. And I said, "Well, I don't put in a strand. I'll get a some kind of witness here." But she was ignoring me, and then, of course, it didn't take me long. I remembered that they served food. This was food, and it had to be something like whipped cream or some form of foam. But by now, I was in a high dudgeon. I was really irritated, feeling okay. I could tell her what the world was about. And so I said, "Well, can I have some?" And she did look up at me and just, you know, looked, and then returned. And I couldn't have it. I suppose. Well, thank you. That's very kind. What happened with this was that in the course of, I don't think I was haranguing her, but I sometimes hit these Gabby Hayes lateral lisp S's, and I hit this S, and you don't intend to, but I spit. The lights are up, and I could, yeah, we all could see this. And it vanished into the whipped cream. So I had a choice, you know. I could tell her that I had just spit in her food, or I could not tell her that I had just spit in her food. So I didn't tell her. But what I remember about this, and I wouldn't even mention all this unless this had happened, was that nobody in the audience told her either, and we all said. So what they decided for Jim was that he should be in closer touch with the earth to be cured, to be healed, to be brought back to consciousness, despite the fact that he's already naked and twitching in the dirt. They dug a hole, and they dropped him in the hole, and they covered him up. They buried him alive. But being a commune, this was a shallow hole, so his chances were good, you know, if he could recover any other way. And he did, and he came to, one minute he's standing there and screaming at people about the way the world works, and the next minute he woke up underground. You know, it was underground, and I'm not sure, you know, well, who knows, but he burst out of the ground, and there he was, and he looked around, the commune was gone. Somebody had some sense in that outfit. They just buried a man alive, and I suppose they decided to reform somewhere else. And he looked back at where he'd just come from, a hole in the ground, and he decided that he was the last man on earth. And he took off in a panic through the woods, screaming and, you know, running into trees and ripping himself to shreds. When, as he said, he found himself in midair. He'd run out through the woods and off of a ledge and fell on a highway. And a truck came around the curve and saw the last man on earth. And the last man on earth sees a truck. Jim's been a drug counselor in Florida for the last 20 years. Yes, and people come in, you know, and tell them they're... I lost my wife, I drove off a bridge, I ran over a pedestrian, and he says, and he laughs at him. Wouldn't you? I was buried alive. Corina, where you've been so long? got a bird that whistles. I've got a bird that sings. I've got a bird that whistles. A bird that sings. But if I ain't got coal,
thank you.
Surprised to see a guy sort of in the shape of Jim, my friend Jim. Well, he had his clothes on. It was just out cold over here in the bushes. And there was I've never seen an animal in this little stretch. I mean, you know, they're not interested, and except maybe a squirrel or, you know, your standard squirrel or pigeon thing. And sort of like the only fruit left is a grape. What, how's it go? A grape, two kinds of cantaloupe, a strawberry, and the only kind of animal left is a pigeon or a squirrel. So I was walking in my usual cheerful manner through the greenway of my hometown, and I see this guy, no animals around except him. He's out cold, and I'm sort of looking at this sort of the insouciance. How's that, insouciance? The casual sort of nature of his repose. And I couldn't help but notice that there was a rabbit next to his knee. I mean, it was more or less leaning on it, and the rabbit sort of looked at me, and it was embarrassed. You know, we can tell these things. It was just, you know, just hanging out here. And while I looked at this, and the rabbit looked at me, a duck wandered out from behind the guy's head. And the duck didn't care. You know, the duck was, I don't care. I'm hanging out by this skull here. It was stunning. I just couldn't believe that I'm allowed to witness this vernal tableau, Rousseau plus Sterno or something. Actually, what's really popular is Lysol. If you find that you're having trouble getting drunk here, drink some Lysol. It has the highest, up to the last time anybody checked, it has the highest alcohol content of any liquid you can buy in the United States. It's very popular. The people who are into this keep it to themselves because they don't want it to run out. You don't have to do anything. You know, when I knew a guy who drank torpedo fuel when I was in the Navy, and for that, or any other of those substances, you pour it through French bread. You run it through some French bread, and as soon as, and you get all, torpedo fuel at the time was pink. And so when your bread is pink and your liquid is clear, you drink the liquid. Oh. Then you eat the bread because you got so hungry. Lysol, all you have to do is just add a little water. You know, you probably don't even have to do that if you're a real tough consumer. I made my own alcohol when I was in the seventh grade. I had a Obviously, I know too much about it, so I don't go near it anymore. But in the seventh grade, we had a substitute teacher in our Oklahoma history class named Hank Dreadfulwater, appropriate name. And he told us, he didn't want to tell us, I don't blame him, about Oklahoma history, what there is of it, first of all, and secondly, who cares? And thirdly, he talked about Korea, the time he'd been in Korea, and the night that one of the tents blew up down the hill from him because the men in the tent had buried a 50-gallon oil drum full of Raisin Jack beneath the wood floor of their tent. And, of course, it blew up because nobody knows how to do this. So most of us went out and made some Raisin Jack after that. What are you going to do? And I got three mason jars filled up with Raisin Jack, which is raisins, potato peelings, water, I think is about it. And you put it away for a while until it blows up. I never figured out what you do to keep it from blowing up. Blew up my dad's garage. This is really, it's a grenade when that happens. There's glass and the smell. I tasted some. It wasn't very good. There's a tremendous book. It's a great, great book. I gotta recommend it to you. By John Aubrey. It was written in a... It wasn't really written. It was sort of accumulated by John over the course of his life. He was a nobleman down on his luck in Britain in, I think, the 17th century. And he just called Brief Lives. He decided there are people with wonderful lives, wonderful, deserving folks, examples, exemplars of the human being, who should be remembered and probably would not be. So he decided, a noble effort on his part, to chronicle their lives, spend his life as a witness to the accomplishments and glory of these other folks. And he proceeded on his life's work, which amounts now to nothing at all, except a real laugh time and again. Because he'll say, you know, Lord so-and-so may have been born in Sussex, but could have been Surrey. I think had a mare, but it might have been a cow. Who lived, fell off once, broke his ankle, maybe his leg, and it goes on like that. And it's somebody, of course, he was right about one thing. We don't know about these people. There's one thing in there about a woman who marries the gardener after her husband dies. And the gardener has had the pox, and his nose is propped open with corks, and so he can still breathe. There are goose quills in the corks. This is who she decided to marry. He has a moral for all these stories, and the one on that one is something like a penny saved is a penny earned. I mean, the connection he makes is a connection that could only happen in the head of John Aubrey, which is also, by the way, crowned by a sore. Excuse me while you eat here. And that's what begins the book, Brief Lives, is something about his sore. It's on top of his head. And it's evidently there for the entirety of his life. And the only thing he chronicles with any accuracy or any care is the condition of the sore on top of his head. I know I should play something. Great fire or something. Two of his friends go out and decide to loot a church. And in the church, one of the crypts, the big stone lid on it, has been moved over to the side somehow or other. And these men look at. Why am I telling you this? Never mind. Another man's love each one. Some Raisin Jack and whatever else they have there. I'll see you in about 15 minutes. Thanks for coming. Please come back. Wasn't sure if I was supposed to come back out or not, so. It's him, Eloise, what is not him. It was written on the walls and window shades. And though she'd had the little girl, but it seemed her. He went out to Berkeley to take over the guitar industry in about 1950-something. And in the course of doing that, he wound up in a debate with Pete Seeger, who was one of his chosen enemies. And the question was, do politics belong in music, or does politics belong in music? You can tell which part of the faculty I'm from. Pete you know, we know what Pete was saying to Faye. He said, no, it's boring. And Pete would erect these arguments, and, you know, this dialectic would ooze forth from his argument, but John would just say, it's boring. It's like those caves in the Malabar, or caves in India, where everything you say in there comes, there's an echo, but the echo is the same no matter what you say. Well, only in India would they have a cave like that. People go in there and never come out. Anyhow, this is a song that I think it probably is the first time I heard a 12-string, and this was recorded by PC. It was written by Les Rice. He got him in front of the House on American Activity Committee. What I like about it is what the 12-string is. Thank you. be right behind you. We can turn this on. Once again, I am faced with the necessity of coming up with a title. In this case, I think I can use a foreign language and just escape the issue altogether. There's a word in German, it's the most beautiful word in the German language. Gewerbegebiet. That's the closest thing I've been able to find in English is indubitably. But I spend, as I've mentioned before, I spend a lot of time alone. If you one of those, you know, one of those nights where there's nothing out ahead and nothing out back. Nothing in the moment. It's just all emptiness, regret, and despair. You know, say, over and over again, people will come. About this high. I'll come for you. It doesn't mean anything like indubitably means. It's an industrial park. Alexander King on television, and he was talking about shooting up with heroin, going down to the basement of his house, putting Beethoven on the record player, laying down on the floor, putting his cheek on the cool cement. And I was about 8 years old, and I knew who I wanted to be. Beethoven's favorite food was macaroni and cheese. It's about noodles and cheese, but it's, which in the end is about all I have in common with him. Me too. Thing I can add to this to paint this picture. It's the first time I play Germany a lot. I love going there. And the first time I played there was in Dusseldorf. And they weren't fond of me there. They were worse than indifferent. It's like playing for a bunch of reindeer out there. It's just, what is going on? And at the end of the night, I got up to leave and I fell off the stage. They loved it. So this is maybe a dark night in Dusseldorf or a dark night in the Gewerbegebiet. My eye. Now it seems like asking for spare change. Anyhow, it happens to be a record I like. There's some I want to thank you for coming. It's great to be back here. You know, you try to establish places and promoters and so forth where you can keep returning. Otherwise, kind of run out of places. So I'm glad to see you here, and it's always a privilege to play. And I appreciate it. Thanks for all. Thank you.
Yeah.